And I hear everybody say that things are different today. Was it in lockdown? Or was it only yesterday? I saw you standing in the rain. And nothing's been the same since you came around. You came around, round, round, yeah. I've been walking on the sun. I just closed my eyes and then I'm gone.
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Tools of Ignorance podcast. I'm your host, Hudson Belinsky. With me as always, Jonah Bierenbaum. Jonah, how are you, sir?
I am very excited. The World Series has started and we have such an awesome episode because tonight we have Pablo Sandoval and we're discussing Pablo as he Sandovals with Pablo and the Kung Fu Panda doing his Sandovalian thing. So that's a Pablo.
And in addition to that, we will be continuing our discussion from last week on the Texas Rangers with someone who is much more qualified to discuss the Texas Rangers, Jason Parks, the top prospect guy over at Baseball Prospectus, very well informed on the Rangers from top to bottom, and he is a fun interview. We have fun when we talk to Jason. So that's on our horizon today. Also, before we get too deep into this show here, I think we should tell our listeners that we have an email address for them to send their thoughts, their problems, baseball questions, I guess. But basically anything you'd like us to know or respond to on the show, you can send to
toolsofignorance11@gmail.com.
And
we're so professional. We've become like an enterprise.
Exactly. We are. I mean, do you think we're too corporate?
I think so. And I think that we risk alienating the hipster baseball podcast fans with our decidedly corporate approach to this podcast.
Yeah, but the thing is, being corporate is so not the thing to do anymore. So are we setting a new trend by being corporate?
Touché. Yes, I think we are.
It's deep.
We're trendsetters. It's what we do.
It's very deep. It's very meta. This reminds me of something that's actually a pretty embarrassing story. But in the building that I live, there is a what appears to be a painting that is abstract art. And it's just a mixture of different colors. And I spent 20 minutes from a distance analyzing this painting on, it must have been Thursday. It was over this weekend. And I broke it down and I looked at it and determined the meaning of life and found the cure to multiple diseases by looking at this painting. And then I walked up to it and read that it was actually just a topographical map of New York State.
I was ready for you to say, like, it was paint by numbers or something like that.
It was embarrassing. And I did it all on my own, so there was no one there to know about it. But now 6 or 7 people know about it.
Yeah, you just embarrass yourself on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, who goes on the internet these days?
Yeah, I mean, when is this fad going to die out, you know?
Yeah, that and television.
So should we talk about baseball, or we could kind of...
Absolutely. There was kind of an important game and certainly a historic performance tonight in Game 1 of the World Series. But what shocked me even more... Well, not even more, because hitting 3 home runs in the World Series has only happened 4 times in the history of the sport.
Mm-hmm.
But I was equally astonished by the fact that Justin Verlander gave up runs, plural.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he wasn't very good. And not only that, but his opponent, Barry Zito, was very good. And if you had guessed that was going to happen, somebody should be paying you a lot of money to make those types of guesses. it was just a very odd game, and it sort of sets the tone for the rest of the series because the theme is going to be Detroit's bullpen. And you look at a guy like Verlander, and you just expect him to, even at his worst, go seven innings and give up three runs. And then he has this sort of bizarre, awful performance, and it just happens to be in game one of the World Series. It's either it happens to be that, or Justin Verlander just isn't clutch.
Yeah, that's not an outlandish argument at all.
He's not clutch, yeah.
Yeah, it was shocking, and it's absolutely disconcerting for the Tigers and for Detroit fans, and it's scary. It's almost scary that, you know, you have to play another game in San Francisco, down 1-0, and then Verlander isn't going to pitch, you know, for a number of days. So I don't think that they'll be sleeping well in their hotel beds.
No.
In City by the Bay. And, like, the problem was Verlander just wasn't locating tonight. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, it's sort of the issue that he dealt with in his last start against the Yankees when he only had 3 strikeouts. His command wasn't as sharp, but the pitches that he left over the plate got hit out of the ballpark by Pablo Sandoval. Like, you look at the strike zone plots for those at-bats, and, I mean, just his first home run, it was down the middle at the waist. And those aren't the kinds of pitches that you're going to get away with against good hitters, and especially against Pablo Sandoval, because he possesses Kung Fu Panda abilities.
Very true, very true. And so, I mean, let's give this a little bit more attention, because this is something that doesn't happen. You don't see people hit 3 home runs in games. You see that a couple times a year, maybe. And then when it happens in the World Series, it's a very, very special thing. Huge congratulations to Pablo Sandoval. And what he did tonight is something that I will never forget. And that deserves our attention and recognition.
Yeah. And I mean, it was truly historic. And I actually missed the first few innings of the games because I had a conflict, scheduling conflict. But yeah, I sat down with a buddy of mine, and we watched from, like, I don't know, the fifth inning on, and steps to the plate, and I was like, I think the thing I said was, you know, he'll actually have a chance to hit 4 home runs if he can hit a home run in this at bat, and the very next pitch, he went yard. And we were absolutely in awe. Like, our jaws hit the floor.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but he had never faced Justin Verlander before, which is kind of amazing. Because if you look at players who are really good against certain pitchers, it's usually pitchers that they've seen a lot. So, you know, if you look at you know, for example, Pablo Sandoval is really good against Ubaldo Jimenez or Doug Davis. Just looking at a couple of names on Baseball Reference right now. But, you know, that just makes sense. The more you get to see a guy's arsenal, the more you can expect to, or, you know, expect certain things in certain counts and adjust. But to never have faced Justin Verlander of all pitchers, and then to go yard in 2 at-bats against him is just kind of remarkable, and it's kind of just the oddness of baseball.
Yeah, and also Pablo Sandoval is such an anomaly in the sense that he's in that sort of rare company of guys like, I mean, it's very difficult to draw a comparison to a guy like Vladdy Guerrero just because he's so, his talent is so unparalleled. But yeah, he's one of these guys. He swings at a heck of a lot of pitches, and he hits the ball hard. And even though he's a very aggressive and free swinger, he still has good on-base abilities for the most part. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just the whole thing that, you know, he's never – he was just in fastball, because I think both of the balls that he hit out of the ballpark off Verlander were fastballs. I believe he reiterated that in his post-game interview. But, yeah, he was sitting fastball, and, you know, he hits the ball hard, and that's what he did. I guess it's the case of, you know, because he had no experience facing Verlander, and he's never been exposed to the depths of his arsenal, and you know that devastating curveball, the power curveball, and the and the really good changeup. He was just sitting fastball. He was sitting dead red, and he got his pitch, and he, you know, Verlander missed with location, and he put a good swing on it. And I am fully confident in saying that when they meet again later in this series, Verlander is going to attack him very differently. And you know, you would it wouldn't surprise me if Verlander struck him out three times. You know.
Right, right. Baseball is not the easiest of games to predict. So moving on, there were a few other things that happened of note in this game. One guy who really sticks out to me, who I've been really impressed with in this postseason is Pagan from the Giants, who obviously they brought over this year, and has been really, really good, both defensively and offensively. In another pair of hits tonight, Scudero obviously has been great, but they just pieced together hits in the right spots, and you know they obviously jumped out to the huge lead tonight, and there was nearly no turning back. But offensively, you know, what if we've discussed this so much on the show, but maybe they've made the right decision because Pagan is playing in center, and well, I guess Gregor Blanco is not doing much. But you know, it's just this team was supposed to struggle offensively, and for them to score 8 runs is just like, haha, more baseball, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they totally have defied expectation. We anticipated that they would get offense out of 2.5 guys, and they've really gotten contributions from a whole bunch of sort of surprising candidates. Like what Marco Scudero did in the championship series was absolutely remarkable. Right. And yeah, Angel Pagan, since August, he's put up like 3 wins above replacement. He's just been an absolute hitting machine. So yeah, I think it's definitely a case of guys peaking at the right time, but also they're just getting contributions out of guys that, you know, their table setters are setting the table. And even despite the fact that Buster Posey hasn't been himself throughout the course of the playoffs, he hasn't been as imposing as you might expect him to be. Other guys are sort of compensating for that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, tonight he was 2-for-4, and, you know, he looked a lot better at the plate, but Scudero had another 2 hits tonight. And pretty much, I think that on a night when Barry Zito gets a hit, you know that the stars are aligning for you, offensively at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Barry Zito, he only allowed 6 hits in this game, and he was very good. I mean, he was he generated 7 ground balls, 7 fly balls. He struck out 3 batters. He was as good as you could reasonably expect him to be. And so now, I mean, it's so weird that Barry Zito just beat Justin Verlander. I mean, and that's not really what happened, but you know, in the sense of Barry Zito was on the winning side and Justin Verlander was, you know, very responsible for what happened to the losing team. It's just, I couldn't have picked a weirder way for this game to go.
Yeah, it's a thought that's almost like downright offensive. But
yeah.
I was even more impressed with Tim Lincecum tonight, though. He was supremely effective out of the bullpen. I thought that his slider was really tight tonight. His changeup looked really good. He was keeping hitters off balance, and I suspect that his performance tonight might have warranted them giving him a start later in the series. How do you feel about that?
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I think that him being able to just go all out for, was it 2 1/3 innings or
two and a third.
Yeah, I think that certainly has some impact on him. And you know, his velocity wasn't outrageous, or wasn't really even necessarily up in this game, but just knowing that he could go all out and he could show all of his pitches and he wouldn't have to face the same batters twice definitely had an impact on how he was able to do what he did. And just of note, that changeup tonight was that good?
Oh.
Yeah, just a very filthy arsenal that he was throwing out there. And he's just such an interesting guy. I really am excited to see what happens with him in the offseason. But, I mean, for the time being, I think you leave him in the bullpen. And because you really don't need to use him as a starter. Zito has shown you that he can stick it. And he's been very good as of late. I know we look back on the past couple years of data. It seems kind of crazy, but right now Barry Zito is the better option to go six innings or to go five innings than Tim Lincecum is. And so I think if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, well, they've won what, like 13 consecutive games that Zito has started.
Yeah.
I think some crazy statistic like that where they just managed to win ball games when Zito's on the hill.
He knows how to win, Jonah. He knows how to win.
Sure. That's a phenomenal narrative. And I was just going to say, there's probably nothing empirical or there's nothing scientific about that, but for whatever reason... and that's my father's favorite line, and I'm loathe to use it. But for whatever reason, they've been managing to win games when Zito's on the hump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So who's more likely to get a start in this series, Tim Lincecum or Jose Valverde?
Aha.
That's the question, Jimmy.
Well, for whatever reason, I don't think either of them are going to start.
What?
Yeah.
Blasphemy!
Yeah, I know.
But no, in all seriousness, though, how devastating was tonight for Jose Valverde's confidence and the future of the Tigers' bullpen going forwards?
I think the future is going to be just fine. Beyond this series, I think it's going to be fine. But what this means is that you can't trust Jose Valverde for the series. He's just clearly not the pitcher he used to be. To me, he kind of just looked flat out there. He looked awkward on the mound, which is not necessarily a change, but it just didn't work for me. He did generate a couple swinging strikes, but the thing with him was he couldn't even really get to Tim Lincecum. Tim Lincecum had a 7-pitch at bat, and he loaded the count, and he battled, and that's the guy you had to battle, and that's the only guy he was able to get out, and then obviously things got even worse for the Tigers, but he really hasn't done anything to show anyone that he is capable of even pitching in a game right now, much less closing or pitching in the ninth inning. But I
really thought Tim Lincecum was going to walk in that at bat. Especially considering on the 2-2 pitch, he made a borderline, I think it was a fastball, and didn't get the call, and he mm-hmm. stared down, I think it was Jerry Davis who was working the play tonight.
Mm-hmm.
The Gary Thorne was quick to comment on sort of his propensity for showing up the umpire. And yeah. Mm-hmm. Things have just gone from bad to worse for Valverde because they put him in pretty much the lowest leverage situation possible,
mm-hmm.
With a pretty huge deficit. And he was terrible. He was really ineffective. But I agree with you that he was flat. That's definitely an accurate assessment. But I think that a lot of that has to do with the fact that they're using him in this kind of situation. Like, that's so mentally deflating for a guy who spent the past several years as a closer. I think that's a huge blow to your confidence, and that's reflected in his performance and his demeanor. Like, he didn't have the same kind of exuberance to his annoying, stupid little mannerisms that he usually has.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think that's definitely related to the fact that he was used in a situation that he knows is you know, it's a low leverage situation, and you know, they were just using him to sort of gauge where he's at, and I think he was totally cognizant of that tonight.
Yeah, and but at the same time, I totally see what Jim Leland was trying to do, because this is a guy who is sort of, we all can acknowledge that when he's on, he's very, very good, or he has been very, very good. And so if you can kind of give him this, you know, he goes in, he strikes out the pitcher, and then he goes and gets out Pagan and Scudero, has this 1-2-3 inning, starts to build a little bit of confidence, and you know, then you can possibly, you know, use him again in the series, and then maybe, you know, maybe you have Jose Valverde again. So I totally see the train of thought, and also I kind of think that, you know, what do you have to lose? You know, it's already a 6-1 game at this point. It's unlikely that you're going to come back. So I think the possible benefit outweighs the risk of losing Valverde for the series.
Yeah, I agree with you. And to totally change subjects, another thing that I felt tonight is that it's just such a treat to watch Brandon Crawford play defense.
Mm-hmm.
I love watching him at shortstop, and it continues the whole theme of guys in San Francisco just doing, I don't know, like, guys do their jobs well. Like, you're playing up the middle. Your defensive responsibilities are more important. And, you know, the burden of playing good defense is bigger on you. And he looks so good up the middle. And I love that double play combination of him and Scudero. And, yeah, the Giants just in so many ways impressed me tonight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Brandon Crawford, he's kind of, I find him, I think he's really interesting, because here's the thing, he's what, 25, he's at this juncture of his career. I mean, he's very, very clearly an elite defensive shortstop, and he's the kind of guy who, it's obvious when you watch him, and the metrics, all of the advanced metrics, which I'm not sure how much I believe in which is a different discussion, but they all believe in him too, and so that's obvious. But, you know, he hit .248 this year, and he got on base with a .304 clip, and he slugged .349. And I'm memorizing all of these stats because that's what I do. I'm a memorizer. I'm not reading these off of Baseball Reference at all.
You're a robot.
I'm a robot. But what's interesting about him is if he hits .260, .270, he's a stud. And gets on base at like a .320, .330 clip, that's a stud who's giving you crazy great defense at shortstop and is not hurting you offensively. That's a monster. That's a really, really good player. And so he's kind of he's one of those guys who's weird in the prospect sense, because you don't really look at guys like that and think, oh, that's our number 17 prospect in baseball, and we can expect him to be really good. But he's actually probably more likely to provide a good amount of value than most of the top prospects you'll see in rankings this year.
Yeah. I mean, he plays outstanding defense up the middle, and his
crazy, yeah.
His weighted runs created this year was better than Yunel Escobar's, you know, who for his career has pretty above average offensive numbers for a shortstop. So, yeah, I think that there's a lot of encouraging things in San Francisco, not the least of which is that they just won Game 1 of the World Series.
Yeah, and for those of our fans, or our listeners, whatever you guys think, consider yourself, the Giants need to win 3 more games, and if they do that, then they'll win the World Series.
That was like a John Heyman tweet.
We should just have a section of the show where we just talk in Heyman.
Yeah.
Like,
report out of San Francisco, team that scores more runs will win tonight.
Like, hearing that Pablo Sandoval will be in the lineup for game 2.
No, you're speculating there, John.
I don't have 2 sources, but I'm hearing it, so.
Yeah, that came from a lone source, and it's definitely anonymous.
Yeah, it's anonymous. Yep.
So, On that note, I think we should take a break. And when we come back, we will switch gears entirely. We will be discussing the future of the Texas Rangers with none other than the erudite and the very internet sexy Jason Parks. So stick around. You won't want to miss that. You're what I need. I don't want to know. No, I don't.
Getting close to anyone now that I'm alone.
Welcome back to the Tools of Ignorance podcast. Joining us now, he is a writer for Baseball Prospectus, Mr. Jason Parks. Jason, how are you doing today?
I am doing well. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. So last week's episode, Hudson and I talked speculatively, of course, about the future of the Texas Rangers, who we feel are an intriguing ball club going forwards. And we figured who better to actually give us insight into the direction of their franchise than yourself. So just to kick things off, Jason, what do you imagine will happen with Josh Hamilton? Because obviously he's central to the club and the direction that they choose to head in. So do you imagine that he'll return? And if not, how do you anticipate the market will develop for him? Because he's a pretty unique case with respect to his talent and the risks involved with signing him.
Yeah, I mean, he's absolutely unique. The market, I mean, we haven't really seen anything quite like this, so that right there will be interesting. As far as his tenure with the Rangers, if I were to speculate, I would say that it is over and that the Rangers are glad that it is over. Josh Hamilton, for all of his on-the-field heroics, there was a lot of drama that went on with Josh Hamilton, from his constant battle with sobriety, which, you know, that's something that can afflict anybody. And, you know, he had to handle it the best way he knew how to handle it. Unfortunately, when you are the organization paying millions of dollars to that player, you know, it's a gamble. You know, Josh Hamilton is a guy that, you know, wasn't even allowed to carry his own currency, had to have a team handler assigned to him, you know, to make sure that he was on the up and up. He was followed places. He was driven places. There was a lot of babysitting involved. And when you start to put all that stuff together, the fact that Josh Hamilton rarely played a full season, that when he did, obviously he was fantastic, but his reckless style of play is what makes him great, but it also makes him a big health risk. When you put all those factors together, it's hard to imagine giving him a healthy and competitive free agent salary. Not to mention there's some other things behind the scenes that would probably want, that the Rangers would probably just want to distance themselves from and, you know, go ahead and divorce from that situation, unless it's just an absolute team-friendly deal, which I can't imagine it will be, because Josh Hamilton is negotiating based on the Lord's voice. Mm-hmm. He is waiting for the Lord, which that makes a hell of a lot of sense, to give him direction in order to come up with a number of his worth. So this is kind of what the Rangers have been dealing with from a negotiating standpoint for a few years now, and it's I'd imagine they're kind of tired of it.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, with Hamilton possibly leaving, that opens up a whole bunch of questions that we can get to in a second. But, you know, the thing that has sort of held this team back over the past couple of years has been the rotation. And there was some time, at least this year, where the rotation looked really good and it looked like a weapon, especially at the top of the American League. But going forward, it really, Yu Darvish is the guy at the top. But beyond that, where do you see this rotation's direction?
Well, I mean, in 2012, I thought Matt Harrison stepped up and was pretty consistent all year long. I mean, not much of a top of the rotation guy, but I mean, that type of guy in a rotation, pitching on the 3-4 spot, giving you, you know, 30-plus starts, putting your team in a position to win almost every time out. I mean, that has a ton of value, especially when you're not, you know, when you're still in cost control territory with a player. That was a premium for the Rangers this year. Holland kind of regressed a little bit. I'm sure that the Rangers were thinking he was going to build on some of his postseason performances in 2011, but he did not. The Colby Lewis injury towards the end of the year, I know he wasn't very consistent during the year, but that's a big game pitcher for them that they didn't have going into the postseason. Dempster was a crapshoot. Neftali Feliz moving to the rotation and then getting hurt. Agondo moving from the rotation into the bullpen to fill that void. There are a lot of things that occurred that made the rotation kind of shaky towards the end of the season. And obviously Darvish stepping up and becoming, a high-quality starter was something that they are quite happy about. But, they need to get better in that regard. They need to bring in some other options. They have, they have money to spend in free agency. They're always going to have money to spend. They have currency to trade with on the farm. They have top prospects. They have players that, if a prospect can be superfluous, then they have those in spades. So the Rangers have a lot of ammunition to make moves, and when have they ever not? So you can look for the Rangers to do something.
And to that effect, do you think that they'll pursue Zach Greinke?
I've had different conversations at different times, and I think that can change the perspective of what we're talking about here. But during the trade deadline, I remember having a couple of discussions with Rangers personnel about Greinke, and, it depends on who I was talking to. But, I didn't get the feeling at the time that they were all that high on him coming into the postseason situation and being a big game pitcher for them. I guess it just depends on price. It depends, if he wants to come here. The fact that he gets to dictate where he wants to go now kind of opens up, it opens up his worldview, but it also closes down avenues for the team. I mean, you can throw a lot of money at him, but Greinke has got a lot of money. And maybe this isn't just about money to him. Maybe it's about fit, comfort. And the Rangers can provide a good atmosphere, a good winning tradition, a good front office, but it's up to the player once they're in free agency, and especially if money is not the overwhelming, overriding factor. I don't see the Rangers going absolutely crazy to get Greinke. I really don't. I think that they will, if they're in play and it's competitive, yeah, they're going to be in there. If they have to go absolutely crazy to convince him to come, no, I don't see them doing it.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And the Rangers happen to have a couple of the more exciting prospects in baseball in Mike Olt and obviously Jurickson Profar. And they also have some seasoned veterans who are sort of holding on to those major league spots, particularly Michael Young, who had the worst wins above replacement among qualified hitters in baseball last year. What direction do you see the team taking next year in the sense of, do you see that sort of youth movement coming up and infiltrating the major league roster, or do you see them sticking with the vets and easing Olt and Profar into their roles?
I mean, obviously, it depends on what moves are made in the offseason. That said, Ron Washington is, he's a good manager. He's a player's manager. He's an old school type of manager. And, I've learned a ton from being just around Ron Washington, the way he sees the game, the fundamentals he knows. I mean, just this guy was born with a baseball in his hand. The problem is that he does become very attached to certain players. He gets turned off by certain players, too. And when a young kid makes fundamental mistakes, Washington doesn't have a lot of patience for that. He's a good teacher and he's a good coach in addition to being a good manager. But at the major league level, it's not always the best time to teach a young player the fundamentals of the game. And Washington will be one of the first people to say that. So if a player comes up and he's young and he's not sharp on the bases, he's not sharp running his routes, he's not sharp in fundamental hitting, which with Washington includes bunting and situational hitting, you're not going to get a lot of playing time. Leonis Martin did not get a lot of playing time for similar reasons. Mike Olt didn't get a lot of playing time because there just wasn't a lot of opportunity for him. Washington was very settled on Michael Young and what Michael Young's presence on the field or in the lineup means to the overall team. Now, obviously, Young was terrible. Obviously, nobody wants to see Young penciled into the lineup that many times again, and you could make a case that Young's presence in that lineup so often really cost the Rangers.
Mm-hmm. And so, specifically with Profar, and obviously Elvis Andrus, one of the better shortstops in the game right now, and Ian Kinsler at second, the mystery seems to be if Profar is in the big leagues, where is he going to be playing? And center field looks like an option for either him or Kinsler. And it seems unlikely that the Rangers would move Andres off of shortstop. But what are your thoughts on that sort of dilemma that the Rangers have?
Well, I mean, I don't see Kinsler being an option for center field at all. First of all, he wore down as the year was going on anyway. Second base is a very physically demanding position. And he didn't have his legs towards the end of last year. He lost a lot of his bat speed. He wasn't taking good at bats. I think the last thing that you want to do is take a player who, I don't know off the top of my head, I guess probably 30. Mm-hmm. You're not going to put that in center. I mean, because then what are you going to get? You're going to have him run around in a very, very spacious outfield. I'd put Kinsler at first base if you're going to put him anywhere. Mm-hmm. Save his legs, get his bat into that lineup. I mean, Kinsler's bat is everything. Mm-hmm. You know, if Elvis is on the team, Elvis is playing shortstop. Profar, I mean, he's a gamer. He could play anywhere on the diamond, but he's never played center field before. You know, he's not a burner. He's an instinctual player, but he's an instinctual shortstop, middle infielder. You know, this isn't as easy as it sounds. I mean, it's not a roto team. You can't just insert players in certain positions and have it work. I mean, it can work, and it has to be an effort on all parties, though. I mean, the player, they have to buy into it. You know, you move Profar, you're going to put him in center, you're going to have him running around a lot. You're probably going to, you know, it changes the scope of the player. It changes the way he's going to approach the game. He's approached the game the same way his whole life. He's been a shortstop. He wants to play shortstop. It's the reason he didn't sign as a pitcher. It's because he wants to play shortstop. He likes that role. He's not going to play shortstop when Elvis is on the roster. Hmm. But he can handle second base. I mean, I think second base is the best secondary position for a guy like Profar. But, you know, the Rangers have a good center fielder. His name is Leonis Martin. He just needs an opportunity. Uh-huh. He's at least a five defender. He's got a six arm, six raw power, some of the best bat speed in the entire organization. You know, you just have to give that kid a chance. You paid him that money. He's ready. You have to just let him, you know, go through the ups and downs of a major league player, make those adjustments. I think he's a good center field option. I think that they could also bring in somebody like BJ Upton, or they could explore other guys on the market. But I mean, I would personally move. If Elvis is on the roster, he's the shortstop, and then I would move Kinsler to first base or DH and maybe some left field. But if you stick him in center, you can't expect him to play a full season out there. Not going to have his legs. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and another interesting position for the Rangers is catcher, as it's looking increasingly likely that Mike Napoli will head to free agency, considering the price of the qualifying offer. And I believe it was yesterday that T.R. Sullivan of MLB.com reported that the Rangers would look to Toronto, considering they have depth at the catcher position with J.P.R. and Cibia, Travis d'Arnaud, Jeff Mathis, and they just made a waiver claim on Bobby Wilson. Do you think that that's an avenue that they'll explore? I mean, there were rumors of you know, totally incipient rumors of d'Arnaud for Profar. Do you think that there's anything, any chance of something materializing there?
Well, not that last trade. That's not going to happen. The Rangers aren't going to trade Profar. I know there's no such thing as somebody being untouchable, but they trade Profar. Because the thing is that Elvis is going to go. Elvis is going to, he's going to test free agency. You know, the Rangers would have to blow him out of the water with a contract, and even then, I'm not even sure. I mean, he's going to be a free agent, plays a premium position at a high level, and he's going to be 26. He's going to get paid. I don't think it's going out anywhere, but Toronto does represent a good trade partner for the Rangers. If the Rangers are looking to acquire a catcher, they do have one quality major league catcher and one high quality minor league catcher that's ready for the major league level. It's just a matter of, you know, the price that they're asking and the price that you're willing to pay. I don't think that the Rangers, you know, see the Blue Jays the only island out there that they can swim to get a catcher. So they want to are a good young catcher, yeah, it's there for them. It's expensive. You know, that's a premium position, and it's a premium quality talent. So it's just a matter of how they want to go about handling it. I don't see them including Profar in any deal. You got to understand, I mean, they started scouting Profar when he was like 14 years old. You get to know the family. You get to know all these, you know, the player very well, intimately. And then you spend all the time and money to develop this player so you can flip him for a guy that you have no real connection to, No, that's really, really risky. That's why those things don't happen very often.
And so, Jason, transitioning the conversation a little bit to Instructional League, and I know you had the opportunity to get out to Instructional League and catch some action out there. Are guys from the Instructional League that stick out to you, a few guys who you think could really make make a jump next year and burst onto the prospect scene?
Just in general or with the Rangers specifically?
Either one.
Okay. Yeah, there were quite a few. For the Royals, there was a kid, a pitcher by the name of Miguel Almonte. He kind of has a similar build to Julio Teheran. It's like 6'2", 170. Lots of arm in the delivery, very whippy. But he was 92, 94, touching 95 with a plus changeup and showing a curveball that had really good shape. He's a young kid. Man, I thought he was good. I think he's a top 10 player in their system right now. You know, coming from where I don't even think BA had him top 30. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge jump. And, you know, I spoke to some scouts about him, and they're like, oh, yeah, no, man, he's legit. I've spoken to guys in the Royals front office about him, and they concur that he is top-tier talent-wise. Corey Seager with the Dodgers, who was a first-round selection for them this year. He's a shortstop. I mean, he's 6'3", really strong, 195 maybe. Really good swing, man. Just really good hitter. I don't think he's a shortstop much longer, but, you know, he'll slide over to third base. He has excellent hands. He has a very, very strong arm. I think he's got above-average glove, above-average defensive profile at third. I think that his bat is going to be very good. He turned my head big time.
Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, your role at BP is expanded, as is mine, and a few other additions have been made there. But sort of give your pitch on what the prospect rankings are going to be like this year at BP and why people should continue to subscribe to BP.
Well, I mean, the information is good, and the delivery is better. You know, I don't pretend to be Kevin Goldstein. I don't pretend to be Keith Law, you know, but I've been doing this for a while. I've slowly built up a lot of connections. You know, I trust them. They trust me. I know how to write. I know what I'm personally looking for. And, you know, the prospect team that I brought them together not to, you know, let's all join hands and create this list that we all stand behind, but, you know, because I'm doing the bulk of the lifting, but I want people to, competent prospect writers who I respect, to say, no, man, you know, I know that you have that guy ranked fifth, but this is why I think he should be ranked third. Or this is why I don't think he's in the top 10. And let me tell you why. I saw him a couple times and blah, blah, blah. You know, and then we start debating. And then this is what a good quality list is bred from debate. You know, and I'm not just talking about internal debate. I'm talking, you know, debate with a bunch of people that you really respect. And that's why the BP list is going to be really good. We just wrapped up the Astros list, just finalized it. It's a good looking list. It is a really good looking list, and the top 10 that, you know, that I wrote up is it's changed a little bit after it went through the BP debate. You know, so that was really, I'm excited about that. You know, I think that the list is better because of that. And we're going to add some features. We're going to take away some features that Goldstein had. It's going to be different. It's not going to be Kevin Goldstein's prospect list. It's going to be, you know, it's a new era. So if people want to continue to subscribe, that's great. I want them on board. I want them reading, you know, a quality product. If they don't want to, well, then I really don't care because I can't help them. Huh. I'm not a salesman. You know, if you like the work, you know where to find it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And Jason, just before we let you go here, one burning question. Could Hunter Pence strike a ball so many times in one at bat he himself could not field it?
Man, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of a crapshoot when you hit a ball to him anyway. So, I mean, Hunter Pence is one of the most you know, unusual players to ever play the modern game of baseball, because there's nothing about him that's modern. I mean, if you told me that he lived in a house without electricity, I'd believe you. You know, I mean, he's just an absolute throwback. And not a throwback in like, oh, he's like Billy Hamilton, he's like an 80s player. Or, you know, Elvis Andrus, who's kind of like an 80s shortstop. No, 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 this guy's like a player from 1915. You know, I mean, he just, his body is awkward. I would have hated to have put scouting grades on him as an amateur, because what the hell do you do? I mean, the swing is unorthodox, the run is unorthodox, the fielding is unorthodox, the routes are unorthodox, the throwing mechanics are unorthodox. And he looks like a complete backwoods goon.
Yeah,
you know, he's amazing, though. He's an amazing baseball player.
He looks like he should be named, like, General or Old Hoss or, like, one of those names.
Oh, he totally fought in the Civil War, and if not, he would do it now. You know, I mean, that's just the type of, and I've been around him a little bit, and he is an absolute, like, gem of a human. I mean, he's awesome, he's hilarious, and yeah, he's country, and I mean, he's from the same part of the world I am. You know, we're about 30 minutes apart from each other from where we were born, and knowing the people I grew up with, he's a lunatic.
Beautiful. Jason, just before we let you take off here, tell our listeners where they can find your stuff.
They can read me at baseballperspectives.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Professor Parks. And I tweet some stuff on occasion.
And you can learn all about Martin Cove and a bunch of other things.
Yeah, you can learn some stuff.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jason.
All right. Appreciate it, guys. Take care.
Never tell what you wanted from me, babe. I feel you down deep inside. Out there all alone, most of the time. You sit by the phone, having the time of your life. I'll take you down. I'll take you down.
Welcome back to the podcast. So another huge, huge thanks to Jason Parks for joining us. Be sure to follow him on Twitter over at Professor Parks. And Jonah, let's transition this. We discussed game one. Now game two and the rest of the series promise to be fascinating. In game two, we'll see Doug Fister take on Madison Bumgarner. What are a couple of things that you're going to be looking for in the rest of the series and specifically in this game?
Yeah. I'm looking for San Francisco starters to be just a little bit sharper outside of Vogelsong and Zito. Mm-hmm. Like, Bumgarner has been terrible so far in the postseason. Kane's been okay. And that kind of surprised me because Bumgarner, he has postseason experience. He has World Series experience. And he's been really, really bad. He's made two starts and he has an ERA of 11.25. He's been absolutely hit all over the ballpark. He's averaging like two hits an inning. He's pitched eight innings over those two outings. He's given up 15 hits. Uh-huh. So he's around the plate, perhaps to a fault, because he hasn't really been striking guys out. He hasn't been walking guys. He's just been giving up hits. He gave up three runs in eight innings. So, yeah, I'm looking for him to be sharper, and he's going to have to be because Doug Fister's been exceptional in the postseason. He's made two starts. And he has an ERA of 1.35. So they couldn't be more polar opposites with respect to their postseason performances. Fister's been striking guys out, which, I mean, historically he's not really known for. But, I mean, this year he did see an uptick in his K rate. But Doug Fister, he's a really effective pitcher. He, you know, traditionally gets a lot of ground balls. He doesn't walk guys. So it's going to be a very, very interesting game because Madison Bumgarner has exceptional stuff. And when he's on, he can be lights out. I think that, you know, he'll have his hands full with some right-handed hitters like Miguel Cabrera and Austin Jackson and Delmon Young. But, yeah, I think that both pitchers have the potential to go out and throw great games, but the pressure is absolutely on Madison Bumgarner to come out and, especially early in the game, set the tone for his team and sort of not cough up yeah, momentum, I mean, it's a phrase that's probably overused in baseball, but not cough up sort of the momentum that they did manage to gather with a big win in game one, because I think that the momentum can quickly shift in Detroit's favor if Doug Fister can do what he's managed to do so far in the postseason and Madison Bumgarner continues to do what he's done so far in the postseason.
And just of note, Madison Bumgarner's 11.25 ERA is just short of 10 times higher than Doug Fister's postseason ERA of 1.35. But
you are a math wizard.
Yeah, just short of. Yeah. So, but basically, you know, I totally agree with you. This is the pressure is on Bumgarner. Obviously, the pressure is going to be on the Tigers to produce a little bit more than they did in game one. But Bumgarner's been bad, and he's been really bad. It hasn't just been not good. So it's kind of critical to, you know, the team for him to go out and assert himself early, because he's really struggled in each of his postseason starts to do just that. And so we look at going forward, if he can kind of establish himself early, I mean the bullpen is there. The bullpen can certainly, you know, bail him out if need be. And he doesn't really have to be great. He just has to be good. He just has to be good for the first several innings and sort of give his team a chance. And I think that if he does that, then this is a team that could kind of run away with it.
I absolutely agree with you. And you're so right about the bullpen. Mm-hmm. Because you look at what they've done, guys like Jeremy Affelt, or Affelt, as it were, and Sergio Romo.
Mm-hmm.
They've been absolutely lights out. So yeah, I agree with you. He doesn't have to be fantastic. He just needs to be good. But even being good is a pretty big departure from what he's done so far. So, game two is going to be very, very intriguing.
Right, right. But Heyman has reported, Pablo Sandoval will be in the lineup. So we can expect him, to play, but how many home runs do you think he's going to hit in game two? Just two, or, you know, maybe three again?
I think he's primed for an off night where he only hits two home runs.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how that affects him and the team going forward with him sort of going to a slump where he only hits two home runs.
Yeah. I don't know if they'll be able to compensate for that offensive, you know, that disappointing offensive output from their three-hitter.
Yeah, I think they'll probably just call up, give that Melky Cabrera guy a call, substitute him in, play him at third base.
Why not?
Just because. I mean, if Miguel Cabrera can play it.
Miguel Cabrera made an exceptional play tonight.
He did. It was awesome.
I was like, who is that man and what's he done with Miguel Cabrera? Because, wow, to his backhand to throw out Aubrey Huff and throw it on a dime, that was... For a guy who was just atrocious when it came to range runs this year in UZR, that was a really impressive play to go to his back end.
Yeah, and that's the thing. He does do those things from time to time. And so people who watch him a lot think that he's good at third base. But the bottom, not the bottom line, but at the end of the day, he just doesn't make those plays very often. And so... A lot of those balls are getting by him that shouldn't get by him. And also, when you look at him, balls that might be more routine don't look so routine when he's got to dive to get to them and make a play like that. But I will give him that. That was an exceptional play, and he's not useless there, but he's not as good as any other major league third baseman.
Yeah, and he's most of the time he's not that graceful either.
No, not at all.
But yeah, you know what I like tonight about Miguel Cabrera? After Tim Lincecum struck him out, he maintained eye contact and nodded, sort of like a nod of, you know, he was conceding, like, okay, nice pitch, Timothy.
Yeah, that was cute.
It was cute. You're pretty cute. and we've never even met in real life. So
that's
just a testament to your charms, sir.
Aww.
You know who else has charms? Ryan Vogelsong.
Going
in game three against Aníbal Sánchez. And Vogelsong has sort of been the antithesis of Madison Bumgarner this playoffs because he's been phenomenal. He's given up 11 hits in 19 innings, and he struck out 18 to fashion a whip of 0.89. And he's 2-0 in his three starts. So what are your thoughts with respect to the Vogelsong, Sing Me a Vogelsong, and Aníbal Sánchez matchup?
Well, I have some history with Ryan Vogelsong. There are a couple of interesting facts about him. He is a graduate of Kutztown University, which is in Kutztown, Pennsylvania, a very small school. He played baseball there, obviously. But he was drafted by the Giants in 1998. And then he had this long sort of minor league career. He was in the big leagues. He wasn't very good in the big leagues. And then he obviously made it back, and he's really good now. But in between him being in the big leagues and not being very good, and him being in the big leagues and being very good, he had a time spent with the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs, who yours truly used to be a vendor for. And there was every Tuesday, they would have a couple of players come and autograph whatever for fans. They would print something in the paper that was supposed to be the thing you'd get autographed. But Ryan Vogelsong, a couple times, was giving autographs. And one time, I remember distinctly sitting at the vendor's office. You'd go in and get your refills of beer or whatever. Was right next to where they had set up the autographs. And I remember once that Ryan Vogelsong was sitting next to John Mayberry Jr. It might not have been Mayberry Jr., but I think it was, and nobody was getting autographs from them. And so I took my hat off, and I got autographs from the two of them. I'm not even sure if it was Mayberry, but and nobody was acknowledging their existence. They were in AAA, and now Ryan Vogelsong is a very, very good pitcher who's about to go into the World Series and shut down the Tigers and pitch really well, as he has done for some time. And that's sort of my long-winded way of saying that he's going to pitch well against the Tigers, and that I really think he's pretty awesome at pitching.
You know what shocks me the most about that anecdote?
What's that?
You came off as something of a fanboy.
Is that true?
Well, it's so shocking to me, because you're so much better than me when it comes to that. Like, you're so not emotionless, but you're detached from sort of the fanboyism of what we do. Uh-huh. You know, I'm just a fan who, you know, who's doing his thing, but you're a baseball person, and to see you whip off your hat and present it to big leaguers to get their autographs, that almost makes me feel better about myself. That makes me feel like there's hope for me.
Well, I mean, I'm not immune to bias. I don't think any journalist type who tells you that they are is telling you the truth. But I have certainly developed fandom for certain players, and I really like players who are, or players or people in the game who are just genuinely nice guys. And a lot of the players who were with the Iron Pigs for the three seasons I was there were just really cool guys. And I had a chance to meet several people. I once met Shane Victorino when he was rehabbing. I didn't actually talk to him. I was just kind of nodded. One time, Liam Hendricks, who's with the Twins, was icing his shoulder after a start. And he was obviously on the other team, but it was sort of like, "Hey, you did a good job," and he was like, "Thanks, man," in his Australian accent, which was awesome. But I certainly do have those types of stories, and most of them come from my time interacting with players in sort of a non-journalist, sort of just human to human sense, and that's what's really cool about it, about what we do, though, is when you actually get to interact with people, there are so many baseball players who I just don't like, but you'll never hear about those because I try to maintain some level of professionalism. But we've gotten way off the rails here, haven't we, John?
We have. I'm pretty sure the World Series is still going on.
Oh, yeah. Wait, did Vogelsong pitch yet?
Not yet. Unless we rambled through it.
All right, might have happened.
The World Series is over.
Mm-hmm. Are the winter meetings over yet?
I don't know.
Okay, so Anibal Sanchez is going against Ryan Vogelsong. What do you think of Anibal Sanchez so far, and what's going to happen in Game 3? Tell us exactly what's going to happen in Game 3, Jonah.
You want to know exactly, like the line score?
I want to know how fast by inning each pitch is and how much it moves.
Yeah. I think that I think Sanchez will do well. Mm-hmm. I'm a Sanchez fan, and he's been exceptional in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. His numbers are pretty much identical to Doug Fister's, only somehow, rather confoundingly, he hasn't struck out as many hitters, which is surprising because for his career, he's more of a strikeout guy. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be, I anticipate that it'll be a great pitching matchup because both Sanchez and Vogelsong have been extremely effective in the playoffs. And Vogelsong's been Vogelsong's like emergence to studliness really can't be overstated because it was so drastic and so unexpected. So I really can't articulate how excited I am for the pitching matchup that I anticipate Game 3 will be.
Vogelsong is kind of... It was... For so long, I was just like, yeah, it's Ryan Vogelsong. Like, okay, when's regression going to happen? And now it's sort of like, damn, Ryan Vogelsong's really good. On Anibal Sanchez, very small sample here, but when he has 6-plus days of rest, he is significantly better than what he is in, for the rest of his career when he's on 4 days or 5 days rest. On 4 days rest, 3.68 ERA, 7.8 strikeouts per nine. On 5 days rest, he is 4.03 ERA, 7.4 strikeouts per nine. And when he has 6-plus days, 3.07 ERA and 7.3 strikeouts per nine. But and none of that really concludes or is conclusive of anything. But, you know, it's just something to think about. I would guess that most pitchers are significantly better when they have longer rest. But, you know, that's something to think about. He has not pitched in quite a long time. So something to keep an eye on.
And I will keep an eye on it because
be sure to watch. Yes,
absolutely. And our matchup for Game 4.
Yes.
Max Scherzer and Matt Cain. So combined, we have three different colored eyes. Because Cain is one and Scherzer is two. That was the joke. It looked because like I didn't get the laugh that I was anticipating when I said that.
Yeah.
From you, so I felt obligated to explain it.
You did a good job of explaining it, though.
I thank you. I don't think it loses its luster when I explain it,
but
Max Scherzer has been absolutely lights out for like the past 3 months. Of course, the playoff samples are very small, but. In 11 innings, he's given up one earned run, and he struck out 18. That's just ungodly what he's been able to do so far. And, I mean, that's against lineups, you know, like the Yankees. So it's not exactly like he's plowing through anemic offensive lineups to get there, to fashion those numbers. Although, mind you, the Yankees were supremely disappointing on offense throughout the playoffs. But, Scherzer is pretty exceptional. And Matt Cain has not been particularly exceptional in the playoffs. So what are your thoughts on Game 4, or the pitching matchup for Game 4, at least?
Well, it's very heavily in favor of the Tigers, but I really, really, really like high strikeout pitchers. I don't think I'm alone there, but
you are a scout, my son.
What's interesting about him, Scherzer, is that his contact, the contact that's made on him is not bad, meaning that he's generating a pretty good amount of ground balls, not too many line drives, and, you know, basically not a lot of balls are put in play on him, so it works. You mentioned the 18 strikeouts in 11 innings. I don't know if this is just Max Scherzer the most locked in we've ever seen, or if Max Scherzer has sort of taken that next step. And if he's taken that next step, and if he's this pitcher for the next 2 or 3 years, that's going to be scary in Detroit. If you look at just what he did this in the second half of this year, was just special. Detroit has a chance to have, it's already very good, but if you look at Verlander and Scherzer going forward, if they can both be that, that's just sick.
It's unfair.
Yeah.
And it's unfair because they pitch in the AL Central against teams like the Royals and mm-hmm. the Twins, who are on good days abysmal offensively.
Yeah.
So it's almost scary to think of the unholy things that they're going to do to those lineups, because I mean, a lot of people have long suspected that if Max Scherzer could sort of harness his ridiculous arm, that he could be a real stud. Mm-hmm. And for the past 3 months, he's been doing that, and it's been scary.
Mm-hmm.
The 1-2 tandem, is arguably the best in baseball, as I mentioned a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
But just generally, as a theme, what's impressive to me is that in base, I've always maintained that it's pitching that carries you deep into the playoffs. And if you look at the Giants and the Tigers, their pitching is just so good. And that's why I think that the next four games, however they play out, are going to be extremely entertaining. And I think it's going to be a very compelling series because just from a pitching standpoint, they're so, in my estimation, evenly matched. I mean, you look at what they did during the regular season. Their collective starting pitching, both of those teams finish in the top 10 in ERA. And that's extremely impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just so excited to watch the next 3, 4, 5, 6 games play out.
Yeah, and what's cool about it is whenever a team scores, I'm going to be kind of surprised in some sense. I mean, probably not. If Bumgarner doesn't pitch well, then, then that's to be expected because he hasn't pitched well recently. So it won't be surprising per se. But just with the impact pitchers in this series, offense like the offense we saw tonight is going to be more of an anomaly type thing where the strong pitching performances, the 3-2 games in the, the bottom of the ninth, those games are going to be more common, and we're going to see things like Phil Koch closing games. We're going to see those dilemmas come up, and I'm really excited for that. I think this is a really, really good series, I don't think I'm alone in that. I think that's a pretty well-publicized thought, but I think that you also have two teams that could very easily have not even made the playoffs, in my estimation. I think that entering the year, Detroit was way ahead of anybody we thought, at least in their division. But it was kind of like, wow, the White Sox are doing this. But and then at the end of the season, the Tigers pulled away. But you always kind of thought, like, if they get into the playoffs, then they're really well built for it. And then the Giants, for the past couple of years, have thought that, the year they did win the World Series, I believe they won, was it 83 games in the regular season? So it's cool that these are teams that are built this way, built to win if they're in type thing. I think that's really cool. I think that it's a different way to construct your roster. And I think that you could certainly argue that it's a better way to construct your roster than trying to win 105 games in the regular season and then worry about the playoffs when you're in the playoffs.
I agree. Pitching wins ball games.
Mm-hmm.
It's it sounds trite, but it's true. And that's what, has been demonstrated in the playoffs. Because the teams with the two best pitching, in my mind, have made it. The Nationals, of course, they have fantastic pitching. But they didn't have Strasburg going. And for the most part, the teams with the better pitching have advanced farther. And it's been great.
Yeah, I misspoke a second ago, though. The team I was referring that won 83 games and made it to the World Series was the Cardinals a couple years back. They won 83 games. The Giants, the year they won, won 92 games. So it was less of a if they get in type thing. But still,
how dare you misspeak?
The concept still applies. We should mention this again. If you want to correct anything we've said or haven't said, you can email us and tell us how much you love us or hate us. We'll ignore you if you hate us. But
you can do that by emailing toolsofignorance11@gmail.com.
And hit us up, because we're just making it up as we go along here. So, we could actually answer things or discuss things, address things, expound on things that you want to hear about. So please, give us a shout.
Yeah, and we should offer some incentive that, the first person to email us can be on the show for 5 minutes.
Yep, I second that. And we didn't even discuss this beforehand. This is totally extemporaneous, so yeah.
Yeah, and you can talk about whatever you do in your life, which I'm actually very interested in. I like, what was the show where the guy would just throw a dart at a map of the United States, and then I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but the concept was everyone has a story. And so he'd go to a random podunk little town and then go to a phone booth and look up a random name and then go talk to that person and tell their story to America. So I really like things like that. So we'll tell your story to 6 or 7 other people. Actually, it was more like 5 or 6 other people, because you will be on the show. So you already know your story. Email us, please. We don't have any other friends, please.
And he's not just saying that. That's disturbingly accurate. So before we incriminate ourselves further, I think we best depart.
Well, we have to talk about what's going on in our lives, Jonah. What is the next several days like for you, other than the baseball? What's going on?
School is sort of all culminating into one big cluster expletive. So the next few weeks are extremely hectic for me school-wise, and also watching the World Series and the end of the baseball season, which is very depressing. So sort of my hectic school schedule is compounded by the fact that I know baseball is ending imminently, so... Mm-hmm. I don't imagine that the next couple of weeks will be very good for me. How about you?
Sort of the same. I had a very rough 2 weeks as far as school went. I had a take-home exam that covered everything from my cases in communication class that was due yesterday. And that was a pain in the arse. And then I have just a bunch of other things that were due or were had exams and all that. But I'm kind of out of the water for another few days here. I can kind of slack off just practicing Japanese and watching Mad Men, ramen noodles, and Pop-Tarts.
Living a good life.
Yeah, man. As I look up right now, I can see some instant oatmeal of the maple and brown sugar variety, and then some ramen noodle. So, I have nothing to complain about. There's baseball, there's ramen noodles. It's a very good life, Jonah.
I envy you, sir.
Yeah. And, I mean, you have to be in Canada, so.
That's my cross to bear.
All right, Jonah. I think our listeners are getting tired.
Our shtick.
Yeah, I mean, well, if anyone's made it to this part of the show, but.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for tuning in to this week's episode of the Tools of Ignorance podcast. Once again, be sure to hit us up via email at toolsofignorance11@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.